Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With the June 5th California primary 2 days away and the expectation that the results will be a bellwether for the Democrats' chances of taking the House and possibly the Senate in November, we'll begin with Cenk Uygur, the host and founder of the Young Turks Network, the Young Turks, the largest online news show in the world, and the CEO of the Young Turks Network. He joins us to discuss the possibilities of flipping the 14 Republican-held House seats in California. And while Trump is deeply unpopular in California, with Republicans now in third place in registration after independents and Democrats, Democrats' chances may be hampered by overcrowded fields of hopefuls, fratricide between the DCCC and the California Democratic Party, and the so-called jungle primary, which has the top two vote winners advancing to the general election regardless of party affiliation. We will assess whether the conventional wisdom of running centrist Democrats against Republican incumbents holds anymore, since running Republican light Democrats dampens the enthusiasm of the progressive majority in the state, where grassroots fundraising is proving just as effective as corporate donations. And as the Bernie Sanders campaign has shown, there is widespread populist appeal for progressive politics. Then we'll speak with Chuck Collins, who directs the program on inequality at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is the co-editor of inequality.org and the author of Born on Third Base, a 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. And his latest book, just out, is Inequality in America Irreversible. With the UN warning that Trump's cruel policies of rewarding billionaires and punishing the poor are pushing inequality in the United States to a dangerous level, we will discuss Chuck Collins' policy agenda to reverse inequality, emphasizing the power of local campaigns. Then finally, with Syria's murderous dictator Assad announcing he will be visiting North Korea, we will examine Trump's ominous reversal of U.S. foreign policy away from democratic alliances and human rights towards the embrace and rehabilitation of dictators and kleptocrats. Stephen Norper, a professor and Korea Society Senior Director for Policy at Columbia University, who was a State Department senior analyst and a fellow at the Korea Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss how Trump is starting trade wars with allies while making easy deals with despots to boost his ratings from the forthcoming Singapore summit, where the press will dutifully amplify Trump's photo op as groundbreaking statesmanship. And joining us now is Cenk Uygur, who is the host and founder of The Young Turks, the largest online news show in the world. He's also the CEO of The Young Turks Network. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cenk Uygur.
Thank you for having me, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Cenk. And we're only a couple of days away from a very, very important primary in California, which many people see as a bellwether for the Democrats' possibilities of taking back the House in November. And you've got 14 Republicans who are, by definition, vulnerable. At least 11 of the 14 voted for this petty and punitive tax increase on the state of California, punishing a successful blue state at the hands of a bunch of red state Republicans. And now there's a sense that maybe with this overabundance of Democratic hopefuls, along with California's top two primary mandate, that the Democrats may be shooting themselves in the foot. What's your sense of what's going to happen on Tuesday in terms of knocking off these congressional seats in the state of California?
Well, look, we have a really interesting situation here in California. As we all know, we've got the jungle primary. And so far, it has largely helped Democrats and progressives because it allows you to have a choice between a more progressive candidate and a less progressive candidate. Usually, these days, there is a tremendous number of people running, so that could affect, I would imagine, a very small number of districts where it's leading less Republican overall, but there's so many Democrats in the race that a couple of Republicans could sneak in. But in most of the situations, your worst case is still going to be a Democrat versus a Republican, which is where we would have been normally. But what I tell everybody and what I want to tell them today is, for God's sake, vote in the primaries. They're much more important than the general election. By the time we get to the general election, we usually have a lesser of two evils choices. In the primaries, you have great candidates. I happen to be supporting Allison Hartson for the Senate race. And I think that that's when you progressives especially need to show up in force. So we have wonderful choices in the general election and not terrible ones.
But how does that impact the general in the sense that the conventional wisdom is if you're running against a Republican, particularly if it's an incumbent, somebody that's too far to the left doesn't have a chance compared to somebody that's a little closer to the center?
So that's conventional wisdom is 100% wrong. It's pushed by our establishment Democrats who've lost 1,000 seats across the country at the state level, who lost the House, the Senate, and who lost the White House to Donald Trump. What would they know? They're literally the worst at elections, the worst I've ever seen in my life. Now, in reality, there's two possible areas, and in both of those cases, I think it helps to be more progressive. One is in deeply blue states like California. It's a preposterous idea that you would need a more centrist, moderate, conservative, corporate Democrat to beat a Republican. No, you need a real progressive that energizes the voters of California. In a blue state, that idea that you have to run a corporate Democrat is ridiculous, absolutely unjustifiable. In purple and red states, I would argue, and the polling indicates, that a populist progressive who is against corruption and wants to get money out of politics does far, far better than a corporate Republican-like Democrat. And the polling indicates that, but of course, almost all the Democrats at the national level are corporate Democrats, so they're purposely blind to the math.
Well, also, I don't think the lesson of Bernie Sanders has been particularly well learned by the Democratic Party. He came out of nowhere and did extraordinarily well and also showed a whole different form of fundraising so that you're not compromised by corporate donors, but rather you have a grassroots constituency. What the average was, what, $27 per individual that Bernie raised?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in every poll, it showed that Bernie Sanders did significantly better than Hillary Clinton against every Republican in the race, including Donald Trump. But everyone on television all of a sudden couldn't read numbers, and they refused to believe it because they loved Hillary Clinton so much and they hated Bernie Sanders so much. But I can actually read. I can do math. I'm familiar with numbers. The polling indicates that populist progressives do much better. You know why? 93% of the country thinks that the politicians serve their donors and not their voters. So that's why Allison Hartson is resonating, because she ran a national nonprofit for 5 years to get money out of politics. So she has now more small-dollar donations than Dianne Feinstein and KDL combined. She has more volunteers than the rest of the field combined. She's got over 2,000 volunteers. She has more social media engagement than the rest of the field, the other 31 candidates combined. Because if you run an uncorrupted campaign like Allison is, then, hey, guess what? People are on your side. We've got to get the money out of politics.
So how then do you explain the polling where Feinstein's, this is the Berkeley IGS poll. It has Dianne Feinstein at 36%, Kevin DeLeon 11%, then I guess Allison's there with other Democratic candidates at 6%.
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of different polls out. The last two polls have Allison within 2 points of KDL, and that's a statistical tie. The margin of error is 4%, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, Ian, you know politics, so there's two factors. One is once they get to know all the candidates, who they like better. I wish that was all of the consideration, because when we do our internal polling and show the – and mind you, it's ours and it's not scientific. I totally grant that, right? But when we show the different policy positions of the candidates, Allison wins overwhelmingly. And in a one-on-one matchup with Feinstein, I would be shocked if she didn't beat Feinstein. I'd lay down any kind of money that she would beat Feinstein. Because you need a strong progressive showing you how terribly conservative Feinstein is. Pro-death penalty, doesn't want to legalize marijuana, hates Medicare for all, repeats Republican talking points on that, voted for Bush's Iraq war, voted for Bush's tax cuts, et cetera. The problem is that the reason we got to get money out of politics is because money drowns out that. The most important factor is how do they even know their names? So somebody comes into the race recently and dumps a million or even more into ads, and all of a sudden he rises 5 points in the polls because that's the person they heard of. So if we had public financing instead of private financing of elections, we would get candidates that were so much more representative of our opinion. So Allison doesn't take any corporate PAC money, so she's got these small dollar donations, and she's doing the best she can in getting her message out on that, and has gotten to a point where she's within striking distance. That's why I'm going around telling everybody right now, June 5th is the most important thing in the world. You have got to go vote on June 5th, and I'm hoping you vote for Allison Hartson.
Well, the rumor is, of course, that Dianne Feinstein will only serve for a couple of years if she's reelected, and then with Gavin Newsom, the likely governor, appoint the mayor of Los Angeles, Garcetti, in her seat to boost his chances for running for president. That's what I'm hearing.
Yes. So, look, that's the thing. If someone else makes it to the runoff against Feinstein, they're going to play patty cakes, and they're not going to run to win. It's almost controlled opposition. The other candidates have run no tough ads. Allison's ads are pointing out Feinstein's record. If she runs that kind of strong a campaign, it's going to foil this elitist, horrible plan that they have where Feinstein runs for the 88th time in a row and then pass it off to another establishment friend of theirs. It's gross what they're doing. The good news is Feinstein's numbers are actually really soft for an incumbent like her against people who don't have a lot of name recognition. To be under 50% is a terrible number. We will defeat her in the general, but it's got to be Allison Hartson. If the other guys run their soft campaigns, this is all probably a launch pad for Eric Garcetti, and that's the kind of gamesmanship that the American people hate.
And again, I'm speaking with Cenk Uygur, the host and founder of The Young Turks, the largest online news show in the world, and he's also the CEO of the Young Turks Network. So let's turn to some of the congressional races, because there you do have, I think, a flagrant example of the Democratic Party being split, particularly in running against Dana Rohrabacher, who should be vulnerable. After all, Kevin McCarthy, the number two Republican, if not the next Speaker, or at least the next leader of the Republican House, he said in a private conversation with Speaker Ryan and a couple of other top Republicans, he said, "I swear to God, Dana Rohrabacher and Donald Trump are on Putin's payroll." And then, of course, it was quickly hushed up by Speaker Ryan, and they pretended it was all a joke. This guy is so crooked, so disgraceful, and treasonous, and yet the Democrats look like they're bungling the chance to knock him off. The DCCC is running one candidate, and the California Democratic Party is running another challenger on the Democratic side. So is that not a flagrant example of fratricide?
Well, so, Ian, there's one issue there, right? And I could use different congressional districts to make the example. So let's talk about Duncan Hunter Jr.'s seat for a second. Mm-hmm. An almost equally reprehensible Republican to Rohrabacher. That's the 50th district. And in that district, there's a clear leader. His name is Amar Kampanijar. He is polling in second place, is likely to make the runoff, got 97% of the Democratic delegates to endorse him. He has a Democratic endorsement at the California Democratic Party. He's a justice Democrat. That means he's uncorrupted, no corporate PAC money, all the progressive groups behind him. The DCCC comes in and spends it, a huge amount of money, supporting the guy who's in fifth place. And then they say, why don't you guys bow your heads and take out your more popular candidate, because we've already anointed someone who was a Republican 3 minutes ago. No, that makes no sense. Why would we let you corporate fools run another campaign like this and support the guy who's in fifth place instead of supporting the guy who's in second place? So if they decide to withdraw their candidate, DCCC, great, then they will have done the Democratic Party a great favor. But if they continue to run deeply unpopular candidates and just throw millions of dollars behind them, they're the ones committing this grave offense against Democratic voters in California.
Well, of course, Duncan Hunter is being investigated and likely to be indicted. He's not exactly a solid candidate. He's quite beatable.
That's right. And if you run a populist campaign, as Amar is going to do, focusing on getting money out of politics, overwhelmingly, even 90% of Republican voters agree. Yes, they're corrupt. Get them out. So if you run the DCCC candidate, he'll say, well, I'm also was in the military like Duncan Hunter, but not quite as much. And I also take corporate money like Duncan Hunter, but not quite as much. And he'll get his ass kicked. That's such a terrible strategy. We've seen that strategy lose a million times. But the DCCC is so deeply corrupt. It's not that they can't see straight. It's that they don't want to see straight. It's that they want those candidates to hire their consultant friends. In fact, at the Young Turks, we uncovered a memo where the DCCC sends to their candidates saying, you must hire our consultants no matter what, otherwise we will not support you. That's corruption.
Well, the DCCC, of course, are all about money and what they call triage in terms of spending their money. And they also love self-finances, which is why they basically leaning on the young Vietnamese doctor, single mother, who is running for Ed Royce's seat that he has vacated. But they want a guy that won the lottery, a former Republican, to run. And, he, of course, he's a self-financer, as is Sarah Jacobs, who is the heiress to the Qualcomm fortune. She's running in the seat vacated by Daryl Issa. So that seems to be the pattern, isn't it? If you have money, no matter who you are, no matter what your politics are, they're the one that, well, they don't even have to invest in you, right? Is that the theory?
Well, Ian, actually, it's a little bit worse than that. So let's take the Sarah Jacobs example, so that she's running an ISA seat. There, you have Doug Applegate, who already came within 1,700 votes of beating Daryl ISA. He's the one that chased ISA out of politics. ISA would have definitely lost to him in this election. Applegate is the guy that had raised a lot of money from small dollar donations. He's another Joseph Democrat, does not take corporate PAC money, right? So here's a guy who's polling the best, who nearly won last time. It was literally the closest election in the country in 2016. He's got all the progressive groups backing him. So why don't you just back Applegate? No, it's got to be a rich person. No. We can't have a regular person. It's got to be somebody rich and someone who, if we're lucky, was a Republican until 3 seconds ago, right? And why is it worse than even as you described it? Because it's not so much that they want the guy with more money, because some of the times the progressive in the race has raised so much small dollar donations, they have more money. So Amar's got more money. Brent Weldon in Kansas is a just Democrat. He's got more money, all from small dollar donations, right? And he even overmatches their corporate donations. Amar has more money than Duncan Hunter Jr. But the DCCC still doesn't support them. Why? Because it isn't just about the money. It's about the corruption. If you have the money but you spend it on consultants that are not linked to the DCCC, they will try to bury you anyway. This is a scam for them and their friends to make money. And so they're destroying the Democratic Party for their personal enrichment. We run progressives, for God's sake, vote in the primaries. Find your local Justice Democrat, and there are a ton of them in California. Allison Hartson is at the lead with the Senate race, but there's so many more. Please go to justdemocrats.com, find them. They're uncorrupted. Support them, so that we can break the back of the DCCC and actually regain control of the Democratic Party, which belongs to us progressives, not to some corporate light guys who are there for their own enrichment.
And talking about corruption, of course, there's somebody else running in that vacated seat by Daryl Issa, where Colonel Doug Applegate, as you pointed out, came within 1,600 votes of defeating Issa in 2016. There's an attorney, Mike Levin, running, and he represented, of course, the subprime lender Countrywide. And you cannot believe that anybody would have the chutzpah to run as a Democrat having that kind of a track record. But there you have it. So let's turn to the theory, Cenk, that strategic voting. In other words, there's a theory out there that people should vote for Villaraigosa because the front runner, he obviously feels that he wants to run against the Republican, and he's making no bones about it. So if Gavin Newsom wants to run against the Republican, the theory is that if you don't have any Republicans at the top of the ticket and two Democrats are running against each other, that depresses the Republican vote. Do you buy that?
You know, sometimes I think people overthink it. I really do. All this gamesmanship, and like I told you, the Democrats have done nothing but lose seats, thousands of seats. Just go find the most progressive candidate, the one you believe in a primary, and for God's sake, support them. Get in the fight. Volunteer for them. Donate for them. Like Alison Harrison, those people's fundraisers, $27 to get in. Just find a candidate you love and support them. And don't worry about any theories about who's going to do what and what they're doing. There's actually a lot of progressives that are running for governor. Delaney Easton is one, but there are plenty. So Lieutenant Governor Ashley McLaughlin, an incredible progressive. I would argue a national hero. Go find the candidates that you love and support them, and don't worry about any gamesmanship.
Well, I must say that the Democratic Party has an extraordinary, at its level of campaign advisors, has an extraordinary record of losers who have been rewarded. I mean, if you go through all of the losing presidential races, every one of them, including the last guy, well, the 2008 campaign manager for Hillary Clinton's losing campaign, he's now, of course, essentially become a Republican and is joining the Republican tax on Robert Mueller. So it's extraordinary. That's the part of the Democratic Party that I don't understand, is how in a country like the United States, which is supposed to be competitive, winner-take-all, and the race goes to the swiftest, they have a kind of welfare system for losers who are perennial, and yet they keep running campaigns. Have you figured that one out?
Yeah, because they don't have the same priorities as we do. And this was one of my biggest epiphanies as we were doing the Young Turks, is that, you know, the hardest thing in the world to escape is your own perspective. And our perspective is that, hey, we want progressives to win, so we assume the Democratic Party also wants progressives to win. But unfortunately, that's the wrong assumption. You know, what they want is their own power and enrichment. And so, for example, let's take Bernie Sanders in 2016. Now, you got all the polling showing he's doing better against the Republicans, better chance of winning, etc. So, but they attack him with a fury like you've never seen. They attacked him much harder than they attacked Donald Trump. Why? Because if Donald Trump wins, they actually raise more money, and they have. Oh, my God, the monster's in office. Please send us money. And everybody does, and they all make a ton of money and spread it around to their lobbyists and consulting friends. If Bernie Sanders wins and he gets money out of politics, they're all fired. They're going to fight progressives with every breath in their body because they are part of the corrupt system. So we just have to get it through our heads that most of the establishment Democrats are not on our side. I know I run Wolfpack. Wolfpack is to get money out of politics to pass a constitutional amendment. It used to be that Republicans and the Koch brothers fought us the hardest. Now it's Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic Party that defeat us in state after state and fight us way harder than the Republicans do. They're part of the same corruption. That's why you've got to get uncorrupted progressives in. The good news is we can take over the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders is likely to win in 2020. He's the most popular politician in the country. And if we have progressives like Alison Hartson and the other just Democrats that come in, can you imagine if she knocked out Feinstein? All of a sudden, the power dynamic would completely change, not just in California, but across the country. That would send shockwaves. And you know what they would do? Those corporate Democrats would turn around and go, oh, yeah, I meant get money out of politics. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's what I meant. In fact, they're doing it now. Gillibrand, Booker, Harris all of a sudden decided not to take any corporate PAC money. The Justice Democrats started that just a year and a half ago, and they told us we were crazy when we started that. And now all of a sudden the leading candidates are doing the same thing. And no one else has a shot at defeating Feinstein. Alison Hartson will definitely beat her. Some of her ads have, say, things like income inequality. That's not the bug. That's a feature for Dianne Feinstein. She voted for income inequality. She voted for estate tax cuts. She voted for tax cuts for the rich. Whereas Allison ends the ad by saying, I'm going to get money and Dianne Feinstein out of politics. That's a candidate that's going to run strong and actually get a progressive as a senator in California for the first time in a long time.
Well, of course, at the end of the day, Cenk, if these Republican light candidates that the Democratic establishment run, the DCCC run, if they were to get elected, they end up voting with the Republicans at any rate. So at the end of the day, you don't even win. So I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate you having me on, Ian. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Cenk Uygur, the host and founder of The Young Turks, the largest online news show in the world, and he's also the CEO of the Young Turks Network. And we can take a brief station break and back with the UN warning that Trump's cruel policies of rewarding billionaires and punishing the poor is pushing inequality in the United States to a dangerous level.
Like a sound you hear that lingers in your ear, but you can't forget from sundown to sunset. Na-na. It's all in the air, you hear it everywhere.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and co-edits inequality.org. He's the author of Born on Third Base, a 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. And his latest book just out is Inequality in America Irreversible? Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks, Chuck. And as I mentioned in the bridge, that the UN, in a recent warning, says that Trump's cruel policies of rewarding billionaires and punishing the poor are pushing inequality in the United States to a dangerous level. You are, of course, asking the question in your new book, is inequality in America irreversible? But you're also offering a policy agenda to reverse inequality, emphasizing the power of local campaigns. But let's start with the UN report. What did you make of it?
Well, I think it's a powerful statement because, you know, it's sort of a global acknowledgement of something that we know, which is, we're living in extraordinary unequal times, the gap between rich and poor, but that the recent policies of the Trump administration are almost like supercharging it. The tax cuts, the deregulation, the allowing of wage stagnation and wage theft. So those things are basically supercharging the extreme inequalities we've been living with for the last several decades, and it's a kind of global acknowledgement of that.
And just to quote from the report, millions of Americans already struggling to make ends meet are faced with ruination if food stamps and access to Medicaid are removed and housing subsidies cut, then the effect on people living on the margins will be drastic. Well, we know that the Republicans are trying to cut food stamps, and we also know that the head of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Carson, is also not just cutting housing subsidies, but he wants to triple the rents on poor people who have housing subsidies. So the writing's on the wall. Where's the compassion, though, with the American people? I mean, when you see reports and pictures of children being ripped out of their parents' arms on the southern border and these kids going into a government system where 1,500 of them have been lost, it makes you wonder at what point there will be a real manifestation of, you know, angry Americans, not the angry Americans that Trump stirs up all the time by throwing red meat to his base, but angry Americans outraged at what this government is doing in their name.
Yeah, I think, you know, one good sign is there's this undercurrent of public opinion, which is really opposed to these inequalities. you know, they don't support the dismantling of the social safety net as weak as it is. They opposed the Trump tax cuts, which, you know, tax cuts usually are enormously popular, but people didn't fall for these. There's overwhelming opposition to them. People believe the rich should pay more in taxes. You know, so if our democracy was working right, or if it has any, you know, chance going forward, we're going to see kind of an undercurrent, a pivot, I think, and that anger is building up. The anger against policies that are worsening inequality.
So it's pretty amazing to see how President Trump essentially inherited a good economy, or economy on the rise, and how, you know, going back to Jack Kennedy's adage that a rising tide raises all boats, that he's actually made the country more unequal. Where is the narrative? I mean, you're doing the Lord's work, Chuck, but where's the broader narrative coming from the Democratic opposition?
Well, I think there's a pretty broad, I'm not sure all Democrats have embraced it, as Cenk in your conversation prior, but, you know, there's a wide recognition the economy is not working for everyone, that it has to do with the ways we've kind of reversed the policies that used to do a better job sharing prosperity. We're seeing income and wealth concentrate at the top at a dizzying pace. I think, though, there is a narrative like this really is a dead end. Extreme inequality is going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. It is going to push us into a more volatile and potentially depression economy, because you just can't have economy function when so much wealth and power is at the top. It actually kind of leads to instability and economic decline. So I think we have a narrative, which is how these inequalities are undermining everything we care about. And even some very wealthy people are participating in that narrative, just talking about how it's not even in their interest to allow these inequalities to continue to grow. And I think that really connects with a wide segment of people.
And again, I'm speaking with Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and co-edits inequality.org. He's the author of Born on Third Base, a One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. And his latest book just out is Inequality in America Irreversible? And I want to get to your book, Chuck, but I just some of the statistics that come out of this UN report about the U.S. Being a land of stark contrast. It's home of one in four of the world's 2,208 billionaires, but there are 40 million Americans living in poverty, and Americans now live shorter and sicker lives than citizens of other rich democracies. Tropical diseases that flourish in conditions of poverty are on the rise. The U.S. incarceration rate remains the highest in the world. Voter registration levels are among the lowest in industrial nations, 64% of the voting age population, compared with 91% in Canada and the U.K. and 99% in Japan. Those are just some of the statistics. But even if there isn't enough compassion for the poor, my understanding is that between 60 and 70% of all Americans, and that includes middle-class Americans, are literally a $500 emergency away from losing their house and living on the street.
Yeah, that's the thing that we, you know, I think that people say, well, this is, you know, there's no compassion for the poor, but this is a problem for really the bottom 60% of households, you know, who have very little to fall back on. I mean, one out of five households now, zero or negative net worth. But even if you go up to the median point, the middle point, we're really talking about people who have, you know, as you say, don't even have the financial reserves to deal with a car repair. So that's a lot of people in a precarious situation. And, you know, they're encouraged to kind of look down and blame people below them. But we have to recognize that the economy, the U.S. economy, has not shared prosperity for the bottom half of U.S. households if for 40 years. That explains a lot, I think, of what we're living through now.
And what explains then the, not that Trump has a majority, he certainly doesn't, the person who lost the election won, got 3 to 4 million more votes than he did. But there has to be an appeal there, why people vote against their own interests. And is it the kind of lottery mentality that somehow if you get aboard the winner's train somehow some of the gold dust will or in Trump's case, the ersatz gold dust will sprinkle down on you or trickle down on you? What explains, do you think, why amongst the Western democracies we don't have a Labor Party, we don't have strong unions? There is a fundamental difference, and I wonder whether it's cultural, historical, or psychological.
Well, I think there is a sort of antipathy toward government that has been carefully nurtured and encouraged. I think a lot of people who, let's say that half the population hasn't shared in the economic gains of the last 40 years, you're looking for disruption. You feel betrayed and you're looking for disruption. And that in the 2016 election, that some of that went to Bernie Sanders, talking about an economy controlled by billionaires. But some of that went to Donald Trump. And if Hillary Clinton was the candidate of the status quo, and you've been looking at Republican and Democratic administrations that have not done anything to address these inequalities, you want to vote for disruption. And that's what we got.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Chuck Collins, let's go through, touch the main points in your new book, Is Inequality in America Irreversible? And the extent to which you have a policy agenda to reverse inequality, emphasizing the power of local campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, I think one way to think about it is we know something about how to reverse inequality and build a shared prosperity economy from the 30 years after World War II in the United States, 1945 to 1975. We also know from Canada and the Nordic countries how to raise the floor, have a higher social floor, a safety net, if you will, as well as address the concentration of wealth and power at the top through taxation and encouraging broader ownership. And so there's a range of public policies that do. At the federal level, obviously, we're kind of hitting the wall. But I think in a number of states and localities, we can make some progress. So one example of that, actually in California, we've been talking about restoring the state inheritance tax and directing funds toward free higher education. That question isn't going to get on the ballot for 2018, but I think there's a really strong College for All movement in California that will drive that forward. We're seeing similar initiatives in 6 or 7 other states: tax the wealthy, invest in things everyone cares about. And those have enormous popularity and will probably win in these midterm elections. So I think there are things we can do in states. Another thing I'm seeing is in cities, the coastal cities, there's an enormous interest in how do we deal with the disruption caused by luxury high-end real estate. Billionaires around the world investing in real estate and putting up housing costs and displacing people, often to buy housing that they're not even living in, that are simply wealth storage units. So again, we should be taxing vacancies, we should be taxing high-end real estate transactions, and investing that in affordable housing. Those kind of campaigns, which I outline in our book, is really, I think, the key. Things that really will benefit a wide range of people and reduce that concentration of wealth and power.
Well, Chuck Collins, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and co-edits inequality.org. He's the author of Born on Third Base, a one-percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. And his latest book, just out, is Inequality in America Irreversible? And we can take a brief station break and back with Trump's ominous reversal of U.S. foreign policy away from democratic alliances and human rights towards the embrace and rehabilitation of dictators and kleptocrats. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Norper, Professor, Korea Society Senior Director of Policy, and an associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University, a former State Department Senior Analyst. He held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Norper.
Oh, thank you, Ian.
So I must say, Stephen, that I'm absolutely mystified about what's going on with this upcoming summit in Singapore between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. And now the White House is saying they're also going to have they're working on or planning a summit with Vladimir Putin of Russia. What seems to be missing in all of the press coverage is that to meet with pariahs, despots, kleptocrats, murderers, of course it's easy. These people want to be recognized. They want to be dignified. Kim Jong-un's father desperately wanted that kind of recognition. Now the son is going to apparently get it, and he's getting it for nothing. So far, we haven't extracted any concessions out of him. From what we understand about the agenda in terms of nuclear weapons is the best we can hope for is a nuclear freeze on the North Korean program, followed by a bunch of vague promises. So there's a surreal quality to this, don't you think?
Well, there is. And the danger is that one reinforces autocracies and illiberal democracies. And the American tradition of supporting initiatives with a level of some moral certainty and some authority and some example in the international arena is put to the side. Acknowledgeably, one cannot choose one's bedfellows when it comes to negotiation, and talking, you know, is better than war, you know, to reference the Churchillian adage. But, you know, talking is good in the sense that it gets us away from the escalation we were toward in terms of military conflict and likely war. The problem is that along the way, there doesn't seem to have been much certainty in any kind of agenda. So it looks like the North Koreans at least feel that they have done something by the way of the closure of the nuclear site, which well may have already been compromised and not of any further utility. Clearly, Kim Jong-un feels that he has a nuclear and missile capability that puts him in the big leagues. And, you know, he sees this, as one North Korean said to me, in the leagues of Gorbachev and Reagan. And on the other side, you have Trump wanting to be not only transactional, but a transitional president, or Reagan-esque, as he's espoused. And he sees it as a way to grab headlines on the international stage. Again, you know, the movement to peace is a good thing, and talking is a good thing. Coming toward a peace treaty and a peace regime is good, but it's a complicated road ahead, and it hasn't followed the path of traditional diplomacy. There hasn't been a series of measures that have been ascribed to that have built confidence or trust, and then it results in a leaders' meeting. Rather, it's two leaders meeting almost as if they're CEOs. If a deal can be struck, and then processes will play out, and no doubt it will be a very complicated road ahead, a complex path, lots of setbacks. And the real challenges lay beyond the summit if it occurs.
Right, but you have, in effect, yeah, a reality TV star in the Oval Office, and he is obviously interested in looking good. He wants a win. Some analysts think that he'll get such a boost from this summit because already you've got, you know, the press are clamoring for hotel bookings in Singapore. Of course, somebody also has to pay for Kim's lodgings. Shows you how, talk about the tyranny of the weak. The guy's plane doesn't even have the range to get there. I mean, it's unbelievable. So my fear, Stephen, is that our press will play along with this and make a big deal out of it, and you'll have this massive photo opportunity without any substance,
Ian, you're absolutely right, and you've already seen it this week in the sense that Kim Jong-chol, the general who met with Trump and is linked to the sinking of the Chonan frigate, the South Korean frigate that resulted in the loss of 46 lives in 2010, the shelling that same year of Yeongpyeongdo Island that saw four people killed, the Sony break-in, you know, someone who has been associated for several decades with the Reconnaissance General Bureau, the main intelligence apparatus, and an unsavory character who, you know, comes to New York, meets with Secretary of State Pompeo, goes to the White House, and these almost, well, grandiose, some would say somewhat comical photographs of him standing in the Oval Office with a giant silver envelope, you know, it certainly has sort of a reality TV or a Welcome to Oz quality to it. And it is unsettling. It's unsettling for those who advocate for human rights, whether, you know, it's thinking of the passing tragically of Otto Warmbier or the 130,000 who languish in North Korean gulags, whether it's diplomats who have worked for decades to try to establish a course of you know, creditable advancement on issues of denuclearization or efforts to prevent nuclear and missile development, and they're left there, you know, a bit dumbfounded at how commitments can be made and how people can have access, you know, in the Oval Office. And it's clear that Trump thinks there's a legacy there. There certainly is a TV value he sees. And really what he needs is a win. And with the midterm elections coming up and not much on the domestic front, if anything, not much, if anything, on the foreign policy front, this is an area where Trump's supporters feel he can score big. And he has perhaps notions of a Nobel Prize and ideas that he will stand out in history for this. And there's, you know, everything is possible in terms of striking at a new deal. I don't want to be a naysayer. I think there should be cautious optimism with this process. But at the same time, it doesn't appear that we have a set of really principled tenets that allow us to advance on the path we need to get certainty. And what we need is complete certainty when it comes to verifiable denuclearization. And that will really require, you know, complex steps toward getting IAEA and likely U.S. investigators in to make sure that this dismantlement process is going. So the administration wants to see the North Koreans front-loaded with a reduction in some hardware, but the North Koreans have made it clear they have no stomach for Bolton's Libya-style approach, and one wonders if they'll ever negotiate off their nuclear holdings.
And, of course, Bolton was not in those pictures, too, in the Oval Office. I think the Koreans let it be known that they don't want to be seen with him. Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Norper, Professor, Korea Society Senior Director of Policy and Associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University. He's a former State Department Senior Analyst and has held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. So again, Stephen, my fear is that the press will repeat what happened during the election or the campaigns in 2016, where they gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free advertising because they're following the bright, shining light, and that they can't resist the photo opportunities that will come out of this forthcoming summit in Singapore. But while this is happening, the same president who is basically, you know, looking for a win and a way to look good, and I suspect will sign anything, he is trashing our allies and starting a trade war with the EU, Mexico, and Canada. And by the way, the trade war over steel and aluminum tariffs is totally ridiculous because it's based on a national security premise that if we go to war and we don't have sufficient domestic steel and aluminum capacity, we are at a disadvantage because it would take weeks to, for stuff to be shipped overseas, and therefore we need a domestic capacity. Well, that doesn't fly because Canada and Mexico share a border with us. They're not enemies. So the national security rationale makes zero sense.
Oh, absolutely. It makes no sense in terms of national security. It makes no sense in terms of economic security, and it's just the latest in this administration's line of showing that alliances and durable friendships mean less, and that the transactional element is what is dominant in their thought process. The problem in defining economic imbalance is only trade deficits, and the economic relationships are so much more complex than that. And so clearly the responses that we have seen from Canada and the European Union, and, you know, I think at this point jaws have dropped because they've now seen Trump come in, you know, just off the bat to abandon the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which, by the way, has gone ahead full bore. It's now the TPP-11. And when Trump recently said to his team, let's see if we can revisit it, but it will take negotiations, you know, it was Malaysia and Singapore and Australia and others who basically said, no, it's not open for negotiation. You didn't like the deal, so be it. And now, and then things like the disregard for NATO, the disregard for the Paris Climate Accord, the mistreatment, even in bilateral relations. And since we're focusing on Korea, look at how the South Koreans, you know, were treated. The CORUS FTA, the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, basically having to have parts renegotiated because Trump was unhappy with aspects. The accusations that the South Koreans were freeloading in terms of their having U.S. forces, when in fact it's to the U.S. benefit economically to have those position there. And that's even more clear when you add in the cost of the real estate and others other aspects that the U.S. enjoys being hosted by South Korea. So at a time when they need not only South Korean support, but South Korea is basically driving this process, there are threats on the economic front. And then, of course, with China, whom you need to be coordinating with fully on this Korea situation, as well as a plethora of other issues, to be dancing on the edge of a trade war. And all of this by very narrow definition on the part of the U.S. administration. So I'm sure those who are not allies of the United States must look at this with a degree of pleasure and some amazement. And I'm sure traditional allies really wonder about the durability of U.S. commitment. And that's problematic in a place like Northeast Asia, where if Japan or ultimately even South Korea begin to wonder, people drive for more autonomous capability. And the last thing you want is development of something like an arms race in Northeast Asia because the U.S. is deemed unreliable. And this is just one example on a global scale where U.S. commitment is called into play, and this so-called America First policy seems very selfish and self-interested. The WTO will clearly come forward and dismiss this latest move, and it makes no sense on the aluminum and steel area, as you well point out, Ian.
Well, just in closing, on the last minute, is there a way? I mean, I'm frustrated because I just can't believe this is all happening and that we have a new foreign policy that punishes allies and rewards enemies, and that this will have a terrible signal going forward. And of course, again, I'd like to point out the obvious, which is that, of course, these pariah states, these criminals, these kleptocrats, these murderers, they want to be dignified. They want to be recognized. This is easy, you know, and Trump is doing the easy stuff at enormous cost to this country's credibility and its priorities in terms of moral global leadership.
And I'm afraid you're right in terms of the entire dearth of moral global leadership. That is basically parked to the side until a subsequent administration. And again, the transactional elements may result in some short-term benefits. It's better to be talking than to be entertaining military strike. But remember, that's also in the pocket. If these negotiations don't work out, if subsequent processes are not cooperative, if there's a setback with the North Koreans, now it's elevated to a level where military conflict is almost a certainty. So we have to be extremely cautious. And in terms of the broader issues, as you indicate, you know, supporting Putin in Russia and an administration that has violated civil liberties, that has stunted any kind of democratic leanings and probably stunted Russia's civil society growth and democratic governance for most of the next generation. It will take a long time beyond 2024 when he is supposed to leave office for Russia to heal, to mend, and to move forward. And the economic cost of all of that, and you've seen the behavior in the European theater that has been so dangerous. You see this to think, you know, with Kim Jong-un, one needs to strike a balance, but not in terms of sacrificing moral standing, and to see those who are imprisoned in the gulag, and only to listen to the testimonials of the refugees, the defectors, what they have experienced. This will go down as the killing fields of still the 21st century, how this is even tolerated in this day and age. So maybe they can get to that point where they talk through these issues, and that's part of a complex agenda beyond denuclearization, where conventional forces, chemical, biological, cyber, human rights. But remember, those are very strong concerns, and to try to think that one can negotiate through them, it will take many rounds in many places and many interlocutors to begin to address these questions. We can be hopeful, but I'm a fear that the questions you raise are really the strong underpinning for dubious aspects of this process. And the administration needs to slow down and to take into account these, because if they squander them, if they give the propaganda victory to these oppressive regimes, it sets back U.S. standing and really harms human rights and equity and a sense of good governance in the world we enjoy.
Thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Norper.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Norper, who's a professor, Korea Society Senior Director for Policy, and an associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University, a former State Department senior analyst. He held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.